Peter Thompson from Minneapolis. Some of you were here last night. We started a little journey with Omar Khadr, who was a detainee at Guantanamo, and we basically were talking about a firefight that he was involved in near Khost in Afghanistan. And today, we're going to move to the next stage of his story after his arrest out in this firefight area. Then the interrogation began. So we're going to talk about torture, some of the history of torture, whether or not torture is effective or not, whether or not it's moral or not, which I think is the easiest question to see today. And then we'll look at what actually happened to Omar Khadr and where that leaves him in his journey. And we'll get back to more specifics of that, but just to give you a little idea of what we're going to wrestle with there. Before we go there, I want to, how many were in Alan's session for Bible study? Raise your hand. Okay, perfect. Where I was going to start, believe it or not, was about the things that he was talking about. He talked about it in terms of the wider circle of Christian discipleship. And what I'm talking about a lot in these sessions are some of those same things, because we are all disciples of Christ or of some other tradition. I think largely here, being Christian. But I am talking about a lot of legal parameters. And so I wanted to make a distinction for you before we start talking about those things. And really, we could think about that in terms of the rule of law on one hand, which are these judicial concepts, and they are secular citizenship sorts of things that relate to us in our life, as opposed over here to the kingdom of God. So, I will not repeat Alan's description of the broadening circle, but I will summarize it in distinction to our situation as citizens. When you talk about our founding fathers, and in our Declaration of Independence it says, you know, we formed this nation for life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And then we passed a constitution a few years later in 1789, after the Revolutionary War. And in that constitution, it sets out many of your rights as citizens. And it also sets out, among other things, that, you know, people in this country don't have to be Christian. There is no, there's separation of church and state. And so that's what I'm talking about here in terms of an identity for you. In other words, you know, Bill is a disciple of Christ, and Bill is a citizen of the United States. And so when we talk about some of these issues about foreign policy or any other political, religious, moral issue, one of the complications is that we are more than one person. And all of us define ourselves differently. And so the real basic question is, who are we? You know, yes, we are both. And when there's a conflict between the two, which are we? So, under the rule of law, which is kind of the ideal of our justice system, under our Constitution, we have various rights that we can protect ourselves with. And those rights are like, we're entitled to due process of law, we're entitled to equal protection, so we can't be discriminated against on the basis of, you know, race, religion, gender, age, those sorts of things. And then lots of laws get passed from those. We're entitled to be safe in our house from unreasonable search and seizure. We're entitled to a jury trial. We're entitled to freedom of religion. We're entitled to freedom of speech. We're entitled to a lot of those things. What those rights are basically, as you listen to them, they're self-oriented. They're things we have. And the way the legal system is set up is that we have the right to protect those. We have a defensive right to protect those individual rights. Okay, over here, all the wonderful things that Alan was talking about this morning, you know how Jesus says, take the gospel into all nations. First of all, the limits we have over here are to our sovereign nation, our borders, all sorts of those things. Because when you go to another country, you don't have those rights. So those rights basically are inward looking, they're protective, they're defensive, and they are limited geographically, identity-wise, etc. Over here, who is the primary beneficiary of your discipleship as a Christian? Is it you? It's the other. So, the entire thrust of the part of you, maybe most of you, that is called as Christian disciple is outward going. It is not for yourself. And it is also one of vulnerability. Rather than defense, where you can defend those rights in court and establish them for you, which is some of what we're going to talk about Omar Khadr, to be free of torture, etc. This is just the opposite. When Alan talked about the disciples going out into Jerusalem, it's the ultimate vulnerability. So when you step out in the world, and when you speak, give voice to the voiceless, and oftentimes these others particularly are the poor and marginalized, you are doing it in a situation of vulnerability. And so you can see the way these two operate are almost entirely separate. But yet, as we'll talk about some of these issues and the rule of law, we're also talking about our role as disciples as much as our role as citizens. So, discipleship is outward going, it is without limits, it is without boundaries, it includes everyone, they don't have to be Christian. It includes the other, it includes the poor and marginalized, it includes the enemy, it includes those who have done violence to us, it includes everything. That's how the circle that Alan described is broader and broader. And so, you can see, as we talk about these two things, it's a little maddening, because we're talking about the law and citizenship, and we're talking about morals and Christianity and discipleship, and they operate by different means and they have different goals.
And often that cross purposes?
Sometimes they are synchronous. Sometimes they really work. And you can sense that oftentimes. You know, I think in protecting Omar Khadr from torture, it's exactly what Jesus would do. On the other hand, if you give me a little digression, there was a case that came down last week called Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. And what the Supreme Court held in a 6-3 decision is that the Humanitarian Law Project in California could not dialogue with a designated terrorist organization, or they could be sent to prison, the individuals who did that. And what the Humanitarian Law Project was saying is that we have a right under the First Amendment, freedom of association and speech, to dialogue with the PKK, a Kurdish group, in order to show them ways of nonviolence, in order to show them ways to have their society function more healthily, you know, politically, socially, educationally, all those sorts of things. And so, in that instance, I think the rule of law was totally at cross purposes with the kingdom of God. If we have time later, we can discuss that case in more detail. So, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's a very complicated situation. So, with that introduction, and to kind of keep these things in mind, we didn't quite finish our discussion about war last night. We'll never finish our discussion. In fact. But afterwards, some people came up and we went on and we had some discussions. And, you know, it occurred to me, what those of you who weren't here were spared hearing the specifics about a firefight where there's lots of dead bodies left inside here. One young man, 15 years old, you'll see his picture in a minute, who had a hole blown in his chest so big you could see his heart beating. And a bunch of dead bodies out here on both sides. And, you know, one of the people came up and said, and here's where we start getting into, you know, we're looking at this as Christian disciples, or are we looking at this as citizens who want to be protected by national security, both of which are very legitimate desires. He came up and said, you know, why is it for the last 2,000 years, when we have disagreements or conflicts, the way we seek to solve them is this: to murder each other. You know, because the end result of this case we're looking at is Omar Khadr, a 15-year-old boy who's stuck in this situation because by his dad, being locked up for the last 8 years, being shot up totally, being mentally a mess, and facing life in prison, and the person he allegedly killed, Special Forces Sergeant Chris Spears, being blown apart by a grenade, dying, and leaving a widow and two kids. So, you know, why have we done this? And so I think just before we go to the next phase of our dark journey into torture, I'd like to just look at a couple of scriptures which make this question so difficult. And the person that just asked Alan a question over in the other place raised the same thing, you know. Okay, here are these wonderful scriptures, you know, how about some of the others? And how much has that affected us in terms of the way we have operated as a society for centuries and centuries? Here's Omar Khadr, for those of you who didn't see him last night. That's a book that was written about him. The back here is a letter he wrote to his mother. He has a mother, a grandma, and two sisters in Canada whom he hasn't seen in 8 years while he's been incarcerated at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan and then now at Guantanamo.
Can I ask one question that was bothering me last night? When you keep talking about the widow and the children, is she the driving force that wants retaliation, revenge, whatever? Or is there a political group that is convincing her that's what she wants?
I don't know the answer to the question, but to give her the benefit of the doubt, I would say what she wants is justice.
Okay.
If someone else killed her husband, and if the law provides, and we are contesting a lot of the application of law in this case, but if the law provides that there be a consequence that it be done that way. And I don't know how hard she's driving it or just politics is driving it. But I know there are 700 people in Guantanamo. There's only 120 left. Most of them have been sent back. Most of them have been found to have no really valuable information and have been released. And there are very few for which they have specific information that they could charge them with a crime. The main example that everyone's heard about is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Okay, so here's a classic about, it runs right in, as you read, it runs right into the good old anti-war song that we always used to sing. We shall not study war no more. here is what the Soviet Union gave to the United Nations when it was founded. It is by the United Nations towers, and it is a depiction of pounding the swords and the plowshares.
When did they give it to
them? When the United Nations was founded.
Oh, okay.
You know, like the late 40s, early 50s. It's kind of ironic because at that time it was pretty much declared to be an atheist country. And this is the depiction of that message in Isaiah. And of course, this one that we've mentioned many times during the week, which is an unbelievable statement by Jesus. To not love your enemies and hate, not love your neighbor and hate your enemies, but to also love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So we have the biblical injunctions leading us away from this kind of conduct that we've been talking about. However, this is what Walter Wink says about just the Old Testament. There's 600 passages of explicit violence and punishment and commands from Yahweh to kill people. Some of them, you know, in the Holy War and Ban sections of Samuel and Deuteronomy, where there are, you know, day after day, night after night, you know, commands from God to not only attack and smite, but to kill the animals, kill the women, kill the children of the Amalekites and the Moabites and the Canaanites and the Philistines. And so incredibly violent images of God. So what I'm saying here so far is not only do we have conflicts here between our roles here, we have conflicts here in our canon. And can we just take parts of the canon and disregard it?
Yes.
That's a wonderful debate. There are many people who say that.
He says we do not judge all the scripture or take it to heart the same. We emphasize those parts of scripture which inculcate grace. And that's the Lutheran hermeneutic. And I can't believe how many people abandon that when they want to get their point across.
And can you disregard under that philosophy? Can you actually disregard scripture? Or are you called to do all sorts of hermeneutic and exegetic, you know, efforts to try and explain and resolve and understand, you know, why there is conflict?
It seems that Jesus came to bring peace, and I think that kind of wipes out a lot of that Old Testament stuff. I think when, he kind of gets to trump
that's great. When I first started doing this, I was up here, and we were starting to bomb Afghanistan, and I hadn't really done much theology yet. And as a lawyer, I remember I said to the adult pastor, I said, well, doesn't the New Testament overrule the Old Testament? Like a case, you know, like the Supreme Court can overrule the Court of Appeals. And he said, well, not exactly the same sort of thing. So, you know, I struggle with that. Here are some of the explanations I came up with. And you know, there's something about the Bible. Like, remember the part that Alan was talking about the other day where they had the fire come down and burn up the commander in the 50 twice, and then the third time it didn't happen? I mean, I don't think that happened, you know, physically. But it happens every day. I mean, it's the truth of the matter. Things like that. So, I think the way I approach it is, rather than saying from a position of grace, I approach it from a situation, and I end up at the same place, that you look at the central message of the Bible, the central theme of the entire Bible. And if something in the Bible, and there's lots of them, run really amiss from there, that's not something you need to have run your life, especially when running your life would run it in a place like this. So that's the first one. The other thing is these people who were making the reports, which evidently got in a lot of the New Testament stories, were people who were involved in this particular genocidal activity. And frankly, I had a lot of murder defendants that would say to me, God made me do it. I mean, that's kind of a convenient thing to say if, you know, you've done something like that. And so it makes me tend to question the credibility of those accounts, given who the source is. Also, some of these particular older texts, this is a quote from a scholar, appear in extremely confused and corrupt state with numerous editorial annotations and expansions. So that does my heart a little bit too. And someone else made this argument, not me, but it's interesting that in the New Testament, God speaks, I think, twice. And in the Old Testament, he speaks every afternoon to these guys who are killing him. I mean, that just doesn't seem to really make a lot of sense. There is one other, there was a New Testament, maybe I didn't get it in here. There are also some bothersome images in the New Testament. In fact, right in Matthew, there is a part where Jesus is talking to the disciples, and he talks about a slave. And the slave owes the Lord money, and the slave comes to the Lord.
I think you have it there.
Oh, I have it there?
You have it.
Mm-hmm. Go forward.
There.
Oh, this one, yeah. And ultimately, you know, this is where it ends up. His Lord handed him over, that is, his master, to be tortured. And then it is added on specifically, and I don't know how to deal with this, but this is Jesus. This is the New Testament. So my Heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive from your heart.
This is the gospel of the Lord.
Pardon me?
This is the gospel of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Okay, so, you know, what do we do with this? This is another thing here, which, you know, is difficult. I have read scholars that have said most of the comments like this that are problematic are talking about the end times. And so they are metaphorical. They're talking about, you know, salvation, time after death, and that sort of thing, as opposed to applying to, you know, what should happen in the here and now where the rubber's hitting the road.
Well, so if
please help
apply this to Guantanamo, that you're using a text that I would think would be against that to support that. That what Jesus is saying is if you lord it over the poor, you've been forgiven and blessed, and then you don't share that blessing and forgiveness, there's consequences to be paid for that.
Right.
Right? And so then to torture people that are helpless in your hands.
Exactly. But is God being quoted, is Jesus being quoted as saying that if you don't forgive, God is willing to torture you?
I think when you refuse to forgive, you do experience torture.
How?
Your conscience. You're eaten alive from the inside out. Cancer. Let's
speak up.
Internal torture.
Yeah.
All right, so these are some of the things that, you know, my old idea that, well, does the New Testament overrule the Old Testament? It's just kind of, we're fell a little flat. So, you know, I think we've got struggles in looking at those things. All right, let's get to why you came here today. I don't know why you come to listen to torture, but... Michael, how do I get this segued over to... He's going to be a lawyer, that's why I keep him around here. He can understand how to work all these things.
Is it
All right, so we'll pick it up. I'm going to go through a little bit about torture. And now I am, except for this New Testament passage we just saw, I'm over here. Okay? And so I'm looking at, I'm looking at rule of law things. And that may inform how we, as disciples, look at our world, and I hope it does, but talk about, the law. Okay, there's Omar again. The United States, in its DNA, has, as far as nations go, some pretty good stuff on the issue of torture. We also have some things to be terribly embarrassed about. But more than any other of these fallen institutions we call states or nations or sovereign entities, we've really led the charge in trying to ban torture until 9/11. So I'll just take you very briefly through that. There was a guy named Lieber who was a German soldier and then moved to America and became a lawyer. And he was so repelled by what he saw of the violence and the meaningless killing and inhumane conduct in war during the Civil War that he drafted a thing called the Lieber Code, which talked a lot about, and was a forerunner of both Hague Conventions and Geneva Conventions, about how you wage war, and in part it was to prohibit intentional infliction of any suffering on captured soldiers. Then there were two Hague Conventions in 1899 and 1907, and they used Lieber's work as a basis for beginning the law of war. And in all of these things, indiscriminate murder or torture or inhumane treatment of anyone who had been captured is really the heart of these particular principles. Then the Geneva Convention started in 1925. They got really big in 1949 after World War II. The United States was leading the charge, and one of the great motivations in the 1949 Geneva Convention was the mistreatment of our soldiers and pilots by the Japanese. It's a wonderful man here who spent quite a bit of time, a physician, who is a great friend of the village. And he was in the war, and he was a pilot, and he got shot down in Japan. And he suffered for years there. He remembers, having almost nothing to read except the Bible, because I don't read the Bible, and suffered horrible conditions and was led around regularly in chains in front of the people who would walk down the street, and people would come on and, spit on them and abuse them and one thing or another. He was actually here when 9/11 happened. And I remember the day I came out of the chalet, came down to the dining room, and I sat down with him. And I'd used him as somewhat of a mentor, correspond back and forth with. His name is David Kluwer. And I said, David, what do you think about all this? And he said, I think three things. He said, I think number one, we need to improve security. He says, number two, we need to bring the perpetrators to justice. And number three, we need to make friends with the airport. And I think back on that, and I think of how far we went from there, that, our improvements of security, that, we spent billions and billions of dollars on things which brought almost no one to justice, and people that we have actually detained, you know, there's been so much injustice that it's backfired in terms of world opinion. And I think the Arab world, and more broadly probably the Muslim world, more fervently than before, believes that we're not their friends. So, then Korean War, and there's a little vignette of what happened in the Korean War. Many of our pilots were shot down in North Korea. And after some time in custody, they were, they issued, there was like 30 some of them, and they all issued confessions. The North Korean government showed these confessions, and the confessions were that all of these pilots were in a conspiracy organized by the United States of America to attack the civilians of North Korea with biological weapons. Sound somewhat familiar? And it was uncanny. None of these people had seen each other the whole time while they were in custody. And all of their confessions said the same thing. And what they had been submitted to was not physical torture, but deprivation of sleep, all these kind of homeostatic derangements, cold, noise, white noise. I remember when I was a kid at this age, we heard about all that. We heard that there was these guys who would have a little bamboo pole, and every time the guy would try and go to sleep on the concrete floor without a blanket, they'd poke him, wake him up. And they got to a point where, you know, the only human contact they had or any sense that they were at all a worthwhile human being was the reaction they would get from their interrogator, who would then come in every day to try and get them to confess to this. And they finally got to a point where they all did, even though it was entirely fictitious. And one of the leaders came back and said, you know, I wished I had been beaten up or something so I could, you know, show you the bruises and the wounds to explain why I said these horrible lies about the United States, he said, but this was much worse. So it was an outrage in the public, but the CIA was fascinated, spent millions of dollars studying this, and turned it into this Kubarik manual, which was then the basis for the manual for interrogation in many places, particularly in Vietnam, and also was used as a manual for training at the Army School of the Americas in Georgia. So what is this thing called torture? I just want to tell you one of the most embarrassing things about being, I don't mind lawyer jokes, and I know lawyers have done a lot of really stupid things, and some of them are greedy and despicable, but I'd say about the worst thing lawyers have ever done in the 40 years since I became a lawyer was this. What they did is to find a loophole to encourage treatment that would come as close to the line of torture as they could come, or create defenses for the interrogators to basically encourage this activity. Because the standards are very clear. And so all these lawyer memos were exercises that never needed to be exercised. In Vietnam, all of the soldiers had a little card that showed the Geneva Convention on it. And this is when warfare was beginning to change. A lot of people weren't in uniform, just like the now in Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff like that. And there was a presumption that the person was entitled to be considered a prisoner of war, and they were not to be treated otherwise until that had been overcome. And even then, if they were not a prisoner of war, they were entitled to the other protections of the Geneva Convention, which always says no torture or cruel, unusual, or inhuman, degrading punishment or treatment. That whole little phrase at the end of torture oftentimes gets lost. Because if you just say torture, then, and you're going to try and parse these words very carefully, that means you can do cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and punishment. And that's what some of these legal memos have done. Now, would Jesus do that? I mean, that is clear. Jesus was the one who was tortured. That's the only thing you could call it when he was put on the cross.
When you're talking about the memos, are you talking about most recently the memos, or were there memos throughout history?
I'll get to these memos. I'm sorry. You know, I've been struggling with these memos so long.
Okay.
I assume they're John Hughes memos.
Yeah, right. So
the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, who is supposed to be one of the best lawyers in the country. They're the top graduates, and they are the ones who give advice to the executive. They are the president's lawyer. Okay? On the other hand, what we were doing in Operation Phoenix is that we were following the Kubarik manual and did coercive interrogation, torture, and sometimes disappearances of over 20,000 people in Vietnam. A well-kept secret. North Vietnam was refusing to follow any of the Geneva Conventions because the people were major war criminals. That's almost exactly the position that, you know, we've ended up taking with people in Guantanamo. In 1993, there was a World Human Rights Conference, and a friend of mine, Doug Johnson from Minneapolis, is the head of the Center for the Victims of Torture. And he met with the Bush One officials before going there, and there was great concern that there would be a lot of resistance from the Asian nations not to adopt some of these human rights, basic human rights protections, because they'd look at it as an imposition of Western standards and morality. So they sat down before they went out and they agreed they had to focus on one particular right that no one could ever argue about that was essential to put in the human rights documents, and it was torture. And they all agreed upon it. And the conference went very well. So this is 1993. In 2000, here's the United States. And every year, the State Department puts out reports on different countries around the world. And almost always, the greatest indictment they can ever make about another country in terms of compliance with the rule of law is that if it condones torture. So the United States, in 2000, says, no official of the government, federal or state, civil or civilian or military is authorized to commit or instruct anyone else to commit torture. And earlier this week, we've been talking about whether or not Jesus finds exceptions. Oops. I can't remember how to do the things, but anyhow, no exceptions. No exceptions to not allowing torture. The Convention Against Torture is very clear. The federal statute's very clear. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is very clear. And here's John Hughes' torture memo. He defines torture this way, which basically opened the floodgates to both Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the things that happened there. This definition, rather than even mentioning all of the other definitions I just flashed through, which is, you know, federal law, customary international law, well accepted, this definition, John Yu and Jay Beebe, Jay Beebe is now a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judge, one step from the United States Supreme Court, and John Yu is now a law professor at Berkeley, both very prestigious positions, signed this memorandum. This definition of torture was taken from a medical reimbursement statute that they found, so that if someone was making a claim to reimburse some medical expenses, they wanted to make sure the insurance companies that it wasn't fraudulent, and so they set up a high standard for reimbursement. Has nothing to do with how you're supposed to treat another human being, particularly a human being who is in custody and cannot defend themselves. It has nothing to do with it. In addition, just to make matters worse, they talked about all these other defenses that an interrogator could use if, in fact, that interrogator was prosecuted under the federal statute. And I've written an article which goes through these different defenses and the way it's written by these, and these are not dumb people who wrote these memorandums. They're brilliant. Some of them were clerks for Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. And these particular defenses have no application whatsoever. Can you imagine that a person, if I am torturing you, and then, and you're in custody, you're probably in chains and doing all sorts of crazy things, and I would have a defense that I was defending myself from you.
Yeah.
And their theory was that because she was Al-Qaeda, that, and since Al-Qaeda is out there and perhaps going to attack the United States, this had to be done in order to stop a possible future attack. Laughable theory. Even worse is this last one. At the end of 50 pages of memoranda, they say, if everything we say was wrong, it doesn't matter. We can still torture because the president can authorize it. No analysis of presidential war powers, the balance between the three different branches of government, a long history of precedents that govern how these things are handled. No mention of that, just saying, anyhow, the president can get you off the hook. Then, if that wasn't bad enough, in 2004, these things came out. These memos were written in 2002, just about the time Omar Khadr was being arrested. In 2004, it hit the fan, if you remember, because Alberto Gonzalez was nominated as our attorney general. And they found out about these memos, and the congressman got all over them, and they had to withdraw the nomination, and he retired to wherever. In 2005, we just got these a couple of years ago. There's another whole series of memos based on the underlying rationale of the earlier memos after there had been public disclosure. And the lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel went through like 15 different tactics to try and design them and to say how far they could go before they would be violating the torture statute and therefore subject to federal prison. So I just thought of myself as, you know, if I'm a bright young graduate of law school and I land this plum job in the Office of Legal Counsel and I go in there and they say to me, we want you to write a legal memo about how long we can stuff someone in a small box with no light on it and tell them that we're releasing poisonous insects into the box. How long can we do that before it's considered torture? We'd like your legal opinion. I would go running out of that office screaming, this is what I went to law school for. And so this is after all this is, this is the problem. It's a slippery slope. Once you start doing this, it doesn't stop. Okay, there's a few, I want to get back to Khadr now. Military Commission Act allowed immunity for many of these offenses. Here's one thing I would like to mention. Here's a quote from Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Korn, who's a law professor, and he is reflecting from a soldier standpoint on this whole mess about torture and these memos. And here's what he says. What you does not, you being Y-O-O, John Yu, the author of those memos, what you does not, and in the opinion of this author, cannot understand, is that these treaties reflect fundamental principles that lie at the core of the military profession, principles that reflect a delicate balance between the necessities of war and the dictates of humanity. What those who have or do serve in uniform on behalf of our nation intuitively understand is the implied covenant that exists between the armed forces and the nation under whose flag they will fight, kill, destroy, and detain. The essence of this covenant is a willingness to engage in such conduct based on a belief that doing so will be consistent with the inherent notion of morality. Because members of the military profession have historically understood preserving this sense of morality would be most severely stressed during armed conflict, they were at the forefront of developing non-negotiable principles to limit the brutality of conflict and in so doing limit the corrosive moral consequence of conflict for those called upon to engage therein. So basically what he's saying is that the soldier's in a really tough place. You know, they're supposed to follow orders, they're supposed to engage in all this sort of thing. And if the minimal standards, you know, of decent, humane conduct are now going to be obliterated, the soldier is then left out on a limb, you know, without any support for that soldier's support by the nation. And so even from that standpoint, you know, there's
Peter?
Resistance. Yeah.
I'm up here?
Yeah.
Is there any movement out there at all to go back to where we were? Are there anybody fighting for that?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a wonderful, I gave a talk the night before we came out here for the National Coalition for the Abolition of Torture. People are, you can Google it, and there's all sorts of people that are up in arms about this. And it'll happen. Okay, so what happened to Omar Khadr? But it'll happen only if you, Paul, as a disciple of Christ, is offended enough about what is going on, you know, take some action in the secular sphere to make sure that we don't do to these people what was done to Jesus. To anyone. Okay, Khadr, while he was in, he was detained July 27, 2002 in this fight. He was in very bad shape after the fight. 7 months later, he was shot 3 times through the back, and a big chunk of his chest came out. 7 months later, that was still an open wound. It's an absolute miracle. He survived. At the end of the fight, after this place had been bombed out and everyone else was dead, a soldier walked in and found 2 people alive and shot them both. But Khadr was still alive. He was 15 years old. Okay, so he was then taken to Bagram Air Force Base where all the detainees are. And first he was put in a hospital. From the beginning, his interrogation started. During the interrogation and while he was healing from his wounds, he was there for about 2.5 months when he would not give the required answer, they would dump him off his stretcher and have him fall on the floor. He not only was in tremendous pain, but this happened so many times, he injured his knee on top of everything else. They then would have him carry heavy objects around in the hospital, which caused him tremendous pain during his interrogation. When he was subject to coercive interrogation, he told them he was the one who threw the grenade that killed Chris Spears. When he wasn't subject to a coercive interrogation, he said that he'd never been involved in a fight. He spoke 6 languages. He was there as an interpreter at his dad's behest and was not the one who threw the grenade. So it goes back and forth for years of custody and interrogation. He was intimidated at Bagram by barking dogs. He had his head hooded. He did not know where the dogs were. He had cold water thrown on him. He was forced to carry heavy buckets. They threatened to remove Khadr to other countries to be raped. He was forced to urinate on himself during interrogations, and he would be laying on the floor, and they would pour pine oil on the floor and then cause him to move around in the pine oil and his urination. During his detention, he could hear people screaming at night and assume those people were also being tortured. He was interrogated by a team of people continuously for those 2 months, both in the hospital and in the prison, after he recovered sufficiently to go to the prison. One of his interrogators was an infamous person called Sergeant Joshua Klaus, who had, if any of you saw the movie Taxi Ride to the Dark Side, there's a movie about an Afghan a young man named Dilawar who was killed in custody in Bagram, and Joshua Klaus was convicted of being complicit in that. So this was the same investigator, in part, that interrogated Cotter. He was then transferred to Guantanamo, where he was, when he arrived, he was stripped naked and subjected to a body cavity search. During the interrogations, he was pinned against a wall by two soldiers. He was unable to breathe until he passed out. This abuse was repeated 3 or 4 times. His medical record was shown that he was suffering from glaucoma. He had a lot of shrapnel in his eyes, and they said he couldn't use his eye medicine unless he would tell them what they wanted to hear. He was held in solitary confinement for many months. He, although a juvenile, was put in the general population who he would see, and the general population were ethnically different, and much older, and they were hostile toward him. He had bouts of depression, and he collapsed crying during interrogations. He had his hair pulled, and his face was spit upon. He was kept in cold, alternating cold and hot environments. He was short shackled. That is a thing where they have like a chain on the floor, and they're held down here, and it isn't inherently painful until you get to about 12 minutes, and you have to stay there, you know, until they undo you, and they would short shackle them for hours and hours at a time. He was threatened with rape at Guantanamo. The interrogators threatened to send him to Israel, Egypt, Jordan, or Syria, where he would receive worse treatment. He was grabbed by the neck and arms and dropped to the floor 5 or 6 times on many occasions, and they threatened him and told him he would be detained forever. When he began a hunger strike, the guards would grab him by pressure points behind the ears, under the jaw, and on his neck, causing pain very extreme. So he has been, we filed a motion to suppress his confessions as not being voluntarily given.
Peter, sorry.
Yes.
What did they want from him?
I think what they...
That's a lot of effort.
Yeah, I think what they want from him is his father was well-connected and a devotee of Bin Laden's.
But he was killed at the, no?
His father and his other brother had been killed earlier, not here, but elsewhere in Afghanistan. And so they wanted that, and they want his cooperation in admitting that he was the one who threw the grenade. But I think it's more the former, that is, other intelligence information, which he's 15, he basically has none.
Peter?
Yes?
I know one of the defenses of torture and this kind of inhumane treatment is that it provides opportunity to obtain what, actionable intelligence?
Right.
What do you know about how effective or ineffective torture is? Because most of the hearsay is that it's completely non-effective. Yet that is one of the justifications to do this.
I got it. Here's the short list of read that, but I don't mean the little stuff, but just the highlights. This is put together by the Center for the Victims of Torture, and this is a quick but somewhat comprehensive answer to your question, Peter. Here is 8 lessons about torture. And this has been, this is from one of the 2 institutions in the world that has actually studied in depth torture. I've used their psychiatrists in court. They are training centers around the world to treat torture victims. And I think they are uniformly considered to be experts in the role. So number one, to answer your question, is that torture does not yield reliable information. And that has been testified to by government officials, and it's been the experience and of the Center for the Victims of Torture that basically, just like this case, Cotter's going to tell them what they want to know about background information, about the grenade, anything else, to get it to stop. Secondly, the whole Jack Bauer thing in 24 is crazy. It could never happen, and if it did happen, torture wouldn't work because it doesn't get information quickly. It takes a long period of time for people to become so desperate after their confinement and they're cut off from other human beings and determining that they have no hope and all of those sort of things to get any information. And when you get information, more likely than not, it's wrong. And so if you do have a pressing situation, you want to get right information. Torture will not only be used against the guilty. As soon as it becomes used, it becomes a fishing expedition, and more people are subjected to it. It has a corrupting effect on the perpetrator. This is actually, last month, there was a young woman, an Army interrogator at Guantanamo, killed herself in the aftermath of all these sorts of things. And 2 of her colleagues said that her problem was that she couldn't separate herself inside the wire from herself outside the wire. And so, I mean, this is what gets caused. There have been studies made about post-traumatic stress, and soldiers who are possibly going to be called up have a certain level of stress. That in and of itself is stress. Soldiers who are called up and actually in the theater, like in Iraq or Afghanistan, have a much higher level of stress. Soldiers who have been in battle and actually seen killing have the highest level of stress. And interrogators are in that level. We've never seen any killing, but they're involved in harming other helpless human beings. So it's a terrible thing to ask someone to do that. It's never been confined to narrow conditions. In most countries around the world, it's just recognized by the law that, and where this kind of course of interrogation has been uniformly used, where it is in many, many places, that the statements are just inadmissible. The police can use them for investigation and follow other rules, but they're so inherently unreliable that they aren't admitted into evidence. The psychological torture is actually worse than the physical torture. We had a trial in St. Paul where we had many people from the Cambodian community come in who had been in the killing fields, and you know, most of those people hadn't been touched physically but they had been involved in this psychological trauma and seeing others touched and hurt. And their psychological wounds, you know, lasted for decades. And last two, stress and duress techniques are forms of torture. That is, there's all this legal work done to say, well, you could do this technique or that technique, and it really doesn't amount to torture. And finally, what does torture do? The DNA that we can be proud of, where we led the fight against torture, we have really become. Now, if our State Department was doing a report on the United States, they'd have to put us in the category of nations of torture. And so we have relinquished the moral high ground. And that's what I think we can do as disciples of Christ. We can put pressure on these areas, exactly what Paul was talking about, to try and reverse this. Any questions?
You had something you didn't elaborate on, though, but what Obama said about there will be no torture.
Yeah, he said we're going to close Guantanamo and wouldn't do torture anymore.
So we're still doing it?
I don't know. You know, most of these things, you know, take a lot of time to discover. And a lot of the legal opinions are still, they've rejected most of the legal opinions, but, you know, course of interrogation, I'm sure, is being used. So how it all will shake out and exactly what's happening now, I really don't know.
He hasn't relinquished that presidential authority that was cited in that memo, to my knowledge, right?
He has not, no. And the litigation strategies, you know, have been very similar. There are lots of cases that are pending now in Washington, D.C. for the remaining detainees who are trying to get habeas corpus granted so they can be released. And the Obama administration is taking pretty much the same positions on those cases. And the position has been really this. It has to delay the judicial determinations, particularly in cases where they don't have any information as to whether or not this person is, you know, complicit in 9/11 or Al-Qaeda or something. Delay it, and then at the last minute, when they have lost and they have a possible appeal and they're not going to appeal, then they release the person. So just in closing, I know this has been a heavy load. I'd like to have you join me in prayer. Dear God, we acknowledge that if anyone in our human family is tortured or degraded, we are all tortured and degraded. We confess, gracious God, that we as a nation have permitted the practice of torture. Give us the courage to investigate our nation's use of torture, to understand our own complicity, and to seek healing for both the tortured and the torturer.